Call the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are.
It's a serious question.
I appreciate your passion. I share it. I've addressed this question. I've addressed my personal feelings.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with our weekly wrap-up of the news in the nation, and it's called Just Ask the Press. With me, as usual, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin, and also with me is editor-at-large from CQ Roll Call, John Bennett. We've got a lot to unwrap this week. Donald Trump was found to be a fraud in court in a summary judgment. Meanwhile, Donald Trump has called for death threats for a couple of former members of government. There's an outlying media poll that says Donald Trump is ahead by 10 points over Joe Biden. Dianne Feinstein has checked out for the last time. And of course, we have impeachment hearings on the Hill. Why not? All this and a lot more when we come back, so stick around.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth. With Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not released anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with our weekly Sunday wrap-up called Just Ask the Press. Guys, we're going to start out this week. Where do we start? There's so much to unravel. But let's start with the summary judgment in court. Donald Trump, there was a summary judgment issued, I guess it was Friday and Monday. The hearing will start as to how much he'll have to pay. But Michael, if you can kind of unpack that for us, what actually did happen? Donald Trump has now, in civil court anyway, been called a fraud.
Yes. So Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York, sued Donald Trump and his sons for fraud. And the Trump Organization responded, and we were getting ready for a trial, which actually will now take place this coming Monday, tomorrow. Was Sunday rather.
Yep.
On Monday. And before the trial was to begin, each party moved for summary judgment. Summary judgment is a rule in the federal rules of civil procedure, similar in the state, that says that a party may move for essentially a judgment in the case before the jury trial gets to it, if it can show that there is no genuine dispute of any material fact and they are entitled to judgment as a matter of law. So basically what they're saying is, look, judge, if you take all of the facts of this case in the light most favorable to the defendant, Trump, and you apply those facts to the law, we win. And so why make us go through a trial? Because we win because the facts in relation to the law give us an entitlement to a verdict. And the judge looked at all of this, said, you know what? You're right. And this is how the judge ruled. And so now the Trump Organization has been found guilty, essentially. The judge has preempted the jury determination of guilt because he said there is no fact in dispute here. And therefore, Letitia James is allowed to have a judgment as a matter of law. So she has this judgment now, which says that Trump has committed fraud. And the judge said, now we'll deal with damages. And there are a few other parts of the case that hasn't been resolved this way, and we'll try them. So essentially what the judge found was that in Trump's annual financial statements, he engaged in rampant fraudulent activity. And therefore, the judge said, not only are you entitled to a judgment for this, you also can start dissolving his corporations. It's an interesting aspect of this statute that this is the extraordinary relief that it grants. And Erdogan and Gran, the judge, took the unusual step of canceling certificates that allow Trump to operate in New York. So here we have the beginning of the dissolution of the Trump world, the Trump Tower, and all these other properties in New York, a judgment that he has engaged in certain fraudulent valuations of his property, and that we will now just set whatever different damages the judge believes should be presented before the jury. So it's a pretty amazing decision. Whether now, it's
did he appeal that?
Not immediately. He tried to, and the Court of Appeal said, you know, go forward, have your trial, and then we'll deal with it afterwards.
Can't appeal the summary judgment. They're going to go straight into how much he's got to pay.
Yeah, they're going to go right into trial on Monday, 2 days from today. But it's interesting because this state law that was passed in 1956 that gives the Attorney General these exhaustive powers is an unusual statute because they don't have to prove in this statute that the defendant, Trump, intended to defraud anybody or that anybody was actually hurt financially, suffered a loss. As long as they engage in this pattern of repeated fraudulent valuations under this statute, that's enough to hold them liable. So what that means is this case is going to be appealed and the constitutionality or the legality of this statute, I'm sure, is going to be tested, but that's way down the line. What's going to happen in the coming weeks is that there's going to be a judgment on some of the other aspects of this case, and the jury will have to make a decision about whether Trump is liable for them. And also then we'll have a hearing on and determination about what additional sanctions, fines, and other monetary penalties that the Trumps will pay. So it's a all-inclusive rebuke of Donald Trump and his organization. And they've called them, essentially like they called Trump University and like they called the Trump Foundation before this, frauds. They said this organization is engaged in rampant fraudulent activity.
Well, John, let me tell you what Donald Trump tweeted out right after this. He goes, after four sham arrests, indictments, and even a mugshot, they failed to destroy my family business. Now, Democrats are seeking to bring down the world famous Trump Tower and impose the corporate death penalty on me. The trial could begin as early as Monday. Help me. I'm here to help you. Send me $47. Surprised?
A little surprised that that it could all, be taken away, so to speak. This seems pretty complicated stuff, which you would expect in a guy with these properties and this many businesses and such a, shall we say, sordid past business wise and now politically. I'm not surprised that he inflated the value of, his properties and his businesses and Trump Tower and everything else, because, the other night he's speaking Wednesday night instead of at the second GOP primary debate at an auto parts factory in Michigan. And, he's complaining a little bit in his own way. He's complaining about the venue, it's too small. There aren't enough people, in front of the stage where he's standing at the lectern. And he says there are tens of thousands of people outside. Well, there weren't. and so he inflates everything. I mean, you and I were at the inauguration in 2017. Yeah. There, he says it's the biggest crowd ever. We were also at one of the Obama inaugurals, and you could look out from the Capitol. And you could see people from all the way. You could just see people. No, at Trump's inauguration, of course, you could see the white tarp that the Park Service put down on the mall.
Right.
You know, you couldn't see the tarp that last Obama inauguration, or the first one especially. Anyway, so I'm not surprised that that the allegation is there that he inflated these values. Interesting defense from what I've read about this, at least what their his defense lawyers are putting out there, that, you know, none of the banks, they say none of the banks that Mr. Trump and his business organization got loans for over the years pushed back or were complaining about the values to which they loaned sums of money. So what's the big deal here? You know, and Trump says, well, the banks made money off that and I made money, so we made money. And who cares if it's illegal? We made money. And that is vintage Trump. You know, the rules. OK, the rules are there. But, you know, to him, the biggest thing are how he's perceived, his image. And did we make any money? And, oh, you made money. What are you complaining about? I mean, can't you hear him saying that?
Yeah.
To lawyers or, you know, to these followers, these loyalists that fed him over dinner and lunch at Bedminster and Mar-a-Lago.
It was a Ponzi scheme, Mr. Trump. Who cares? We all made money. It's all good.
Yeah, right. But, you know, and again, you know, they seem to be saying that the laws are somehow, I guess, unfair or too strict. But again, the bottom line from what I've read about the early defense, or at least the public messaging from his attorneys, is everybody made money. So what?
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting thing to take into court. I don't know.
Well, no, but let me say this is what's unusual about this 1956 New York statute, which it doesn't require proof that anyone was harmed financially. Right.
Yeah.
Typically in a fraud case, just as the word implies, someone was defrauded, and that means, you know, something was taken from them, something of value was taken from them sort of unwittingly, you know, with them not, you know, wittingly participating in it. If you give me $100 today, I will come back tomorrow and pave your driveway. Okay, that's great. Here's $100, an advance fee. The guy never comes back. That's
fraud.
Garden variety fraud, advance fee fraud. Or bank, I'm going to tell you that I'm worth this. You lend me money and I will pay back the money. That value was wrong. They have no means to pay back the money, and the bank loses. Here, Trump said to the banks, here are my financial statements. They have big block letters on them. Don't rely on these because they haven't been, you know, certified by an accounting firm. They're just sort of like my view of the values of my property. The bank said, fine, fair enough. They lent him the money. Mm-hmm. They didn't suffer a loss financially. And Trump therefore says, yes, maybe I inflated these values, but because nobody lost any money, how can you call that fraud? Because nobody essentially was injured. New York has said that's not the way you analyze this. If you engage in fraudulent activity, it is per se a crime. You can't say, well, essentially my fraud wasn't successful, or surprisingly, nobody ended up losing money.
But because, you still defrauded people.
Right. And there are tax consequences to it as well. The state says you deflated, lowered the value of property in respect of the taxes you owed on that property. And therefore, the taxpayers of the state of New York
were defrauded
because we didn't get the taxes that we were entitled to get. So there are harms that Trump is ignoring in the Letitia James allegations. But it is an unusual statute because normally you prove the intent to defraud as an aspect of the case. But here, they really didn't have to do that. They have to say, was it, you know, sort of essentially fraudulent per se? That is, when I stated something to be a value that I knew not to be true, I engaged in a fraudulent representation, and that's all that's required, irrespective of whether anyone suffered, you know, financial loss individually from it. So we'll see how this statute gets analyzed over time. But for where we sit now, on the weekend before the 1st of October, Trump has been found to be, by a trial judge, a fraudster who now is going to suffer penalties at trial and has already begun to lose the business certifications of his property. A receiver has been appointed to sort of oversee this. Again, it analogizes to the foundation where they said this is not a, the Trump Foundation is a fraud. It's not engaged in non-taxable fraud, you know, behavior. It is engaged in fraudulent behavior. It is not a 501c3 sort of tax exempt organization. It is a fraud. And they appointed a receiver and they wound it down. That's what the judges ordered here too. These properties will be sold or some such thing. And Trump will no longer, if things stand the way they stand now, at the very end of the day, he will not own Trump property in New York. Some of the other properties in New York. Doesn't affect Mar-a-Lago, I don't think.
Right. No, it doesn't affect. That's the question, is can they yank outside of the state? And according to the, they're not. They're only going to take away his ability to do business in New York and seize his New York properties.
Yeah, which, which is a big deal, obviously.
Yeah, that's, yeah. Trump Tower is a homeless shelter. I think that would be great. We've got to take a short break. The good conversation, but I got a break. So let's take a short break and we'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not found anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask a Question. This is my question, right? And John, you bring up the freaking, you touch it. They have folded every time. When McCarthy said, hey, you know what? Go. Call for my ouster. Did they do
that
it?
That was three times.
Yeah, that's the third time. They haven't done it. So why is there any reticence? This is the thing that is confusing to me. Why is there a reticence to step up and nail them to the wall, because they've already shown they're going to fold? What do they have? Are there cards that they don't have that they aren't playing? And at the same time, I know that the Democrats have been upset, right? Because there was one of the reasons that you have why they wouldn't get involved to help him in the beginning is because he called for this inquiry into Biden as to whether or not there would be a, you know, an impeachment. All right, so now that it's been called, they've had the first one. It was McCarthy said, let the facts fall where they may. Maybe he was playing the long game and go, look, make an ass of yourself. You got nothing. So now he can go back to the Democrats and go, look, you may have been pissed because I did it, but look, that was a great victory for you. Now, will you help me out? I mean, yeah, I don't know what we're seeing, on the outside and what machinations are going on the inside to get us to a point where they won't shut down. That's so. But to your point, I mean, you made it crystal clear. They have backed down every single time. Why not press the issue now so there isn't a shutdown? If they do that, I will be impressed. But John, go ahead.
Oh, Michael, go ahead. Hands up.
I was going to say, what may be underneath the Democrats' thinking is, if you were to ask Newt Gingrich, I think, and others, they will tell you that government shutdowns have not helped Republicans in the past, that they tend to be held responsible, and people don't like it when the parks are closed or they can't get their Social Security or Medicare or other entitlement programs, and military families, you know, fear not being paid and traffic controllers have to come to work regardless of the shutdown. People don't like this stuff. They may rail about the government, broadly speaking, but if you got to go to a veterans hospital and you can't get in or some such thing, people get upset about that. And Republicans are the ones who have been responsible for and blamed by the American public for these shutdowns. So maybe the Republic, maybe the Democrats are sitting there thinking, fine, you know, we got an election coming up. It's going to be a close election. We've got a lot of swing districts that we may be able to take over. And if we can get one more, you know, sort of nail in the coffin of the Republican
self-imposed party, nail,
then, you know, who why would we want to help them help themselves? And, you know, we'll just sit back and watch. And if they are the ones who are blamed for it, then we suffer no, you know, sort of blowback for it. And maybe we get an advantage. If we compromise with them, then everyone is, you know, credited. And that doesn't help us, because you see a lot of articles that say,
so you're saying they're Republicans putting party ahead of country.
Republicans in swing districts are anxious about this shutdown and how it will impact them. All those who are criticizing the hardliners and the Republicans, you know, people, some of the Republicans in New York that surprisingly won last time around, that gave the Republicans the majority of the House, they're all saying, whoa, I'm not so sure that this is a really good idea for me individually.
So, all right, we've got to move on, but I'm going to have,
I got one. Can I just jump in?
The last word on it, but okay. I'll just say before that, what you're also saying, Michael, is that the Democrats may be putting party ahead of country. Let's just, I'll let that one lie, but go ahead, John.
That would never happen, Brian.
Never.
Okay. One card that we have not seen from the conservative rebels is who they would run as speaker, because McCarthy would be on the ballot again. He would be nominated on the House floor by his allies. So who do the conservatives have that could get to, right now the number I believe is 217, usually it's 218, but we had a resignation. So 217, who can get there for them?
One.
They haven't said who they would run. And as CQ Roll Call's political editor, longtime reporter before that, Herb Jackson, put it to me yesterday, you can't beat somebody with nobody. So they haven't done this because, in part, you have to assume, because they don't have anybody that could get to 217. And if the Democrats decide, and Jim Clyburn on CNN on Friday said he could see a world in which the Democrats maybe voted present on the motion to vacate, and it would fail to help keep McCarthy in the speakership, because the devil you know is better than the devil you don't. And if you eventually get a really conservative speaker, well, Republicans don't want that either. I'm sorry, Democrats don't want that either. So that could be part of this behind the scenes, is McCarthy and company know that there's no one that the conservatives have. Now, Tom Emmer was floated in a story. He's the Republican whip. He was floated in a story that posted late one night this week at Washington Post as the conservatives' preference if we get there. But I didn't see that reporting really anywhere else the next day. So it doesn't look like they have anybody, is the bottom line. And no kidding.
That's
right. So, you know, so I'm not sure what they gain by vacating the chair other than humiliating McCarthy, but don't rule that out. That's a big motivation.
That's their hubris. Yeah. All right. So we've torn that one apart. Before I'm going to take another short break, we're going to come back and we've got a lot more to unpack and a little time to do it. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with our weekly roundup in the news, Just Ask the Press. We haven't gotten past Trump as a fraud and a rapist in civil court and the government shutdown, but the government shutdown is very interesting. And the whole idea, well, is quite frightening to many. But nonetheless, there is a lot else that's gone on this week. Let's start with the impeachment hearings. one of the deals that we talked about and the Democrats may not be so happy about was the fact that Kevin McCarthy, in appealing to his far-sighted friends, had allowed, well, impeachment hearings to begin this week, or an inquiry into an impeachment hearing. And it was many folk who, including Jamie Raskin, who laughed about the evidence, there being no evidence, as he sat watching Comer, James Comer from the People's from the Bluegrass State of Kentucky, tell us why we're not going to see anything real life-threatening or new in these hearings. John, were you surprised?
I wasn't surprised. I talked a lot in the last segment, so I'll keep this pretty short. I didn't watch much of the hearing. I did hear Chairman Comer in his opening statement reveal the damning evidence of, we are not going to plow any new ground today. And I had other things to do. I had two products to deliver that day and some edits. And I X'd out of the tab where the hearing was playing. And I didn't hear anything or read anything that made me regret that decision.
Michael, do you think that there will be anything come from these hearings at all?
Well, there'll be a lot of political machinations about it, but whether or not there will be evidence that establishes that Joe Biden engaged in high crimes or misdemeanors or treason, unlikely at this stage. I have to say a couple of things. First is, the witnesses that were called were not fact witnesses. They were about, is this inquiry the type of inquiry that is, you know, acceptable? And the Democrats smartly said to each of them, do you presently have any evidence or know of any evidence that would amount to a high crime or misdemeanor? And they all said, we do not. And so the headline out of the first day's hearing is, Republican witnesses say no evidence presently exists that would amount to an impeachable offense against Biden. That's not really a good headline for those promoting it. But there's, you know, there's,
we'll get to that issue if we have time.
There's stuff out there that relates to Hunter Biden and the manner in which he engaged in business dealings with, you know, possibility of shell companies and other, you know, sort of money laundering like fund movements for payment that are probably worthy of inquiry. But I haven't seen anything in the record that links any of what Hunter Biden was doing financially to President Biden or Vice President Biden or even private citizen Biden, which, of course, you can't impeach somebody for the activities that they engage in as a private citizen. They could be indicted for it, but I think that statute of limitations has long ago ran out. So what we had in day one was a flop from a new evidence that links the president, or when he was vice president, to impeachable conduct. And I don't know that we will ever get there. And I think, therefore, that these impeachment hearings are bound to go nowhere. And if the press continues to be so disinterested in them that John Bennett has decided to do something other than watch it on TV, I think it's going to be, you know, sort of a pretty substantial bust for the Republicans. And they've got enough busts on their hands
it's the theater of it. You're going to have these hearings, right? And John, I mean, if you're a Democrat, if you're a voter, you're having these hearings and you admit that there, or you say up top, and it is bad headline, say at the top, there's no evidence as of yet. And at the same time, you're closing down, threatening to close down the government. I don't know if the juxtaposition of those two images plays well for Republicans. I just can't imagine that it does. But with that said, I do want to change gears one last time and talk about something that really is at the touchstone of all of this. And Michael, you talked about bad headlines. We talked about coverage earlier, John. The other day, the president of the United States was invited to walk on a picket line with UAW workers and did so, made history. The next day, Donald Trump showed up at a non-union shop complaining about the size of the crowd and saying there were tens of thousands outside, and we knew that that was a lie. But also, we saw a reporter from CNN, and it wasn't just CNN, it was others, who said that, you know, Donald Trump is now a worker-friendly. He's for the workers. He may not be for unions, but he's for workers. And there's been no indication of that at all. And then you have commentators like a friend of mine, Waj, I think, who said that we're not doing ourselves any favors if we don't introduce Donald Trump as, you know, a rapist and a fraud every time we introduce him, that we give him too much equivalency, and that we are helping to make Donald Trump by not putting facts out, but by just giving opinions. John, as a reporter, you think we've had our hands in creating the mythos of Donald Trump?
We certainly played a role, in 2015 and 2016. I think especially cable news, he moved the needle ratings wise. They thought he was a novelty act that would fade and a fad maybe, and voters would eventually, and there's no other way to put it, come to their senses and move on to other Republican candidates. Back then, you had, you know, Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and some governors. So you had alternatives. And I think the media thought, well, this is good television and people are clicking on it and tuning in and sticking around when they do, which is important as well. And then, you know, he became the nominee and then the president. It is tough. I admit it's tough to cover this and explain exactly what we're seeing. We've never really figured that out, the collective we, the royal we, if you will. And, you know, he is all those things in the eyes of the court system and his accusers, and now a judge in New York who says basically his business successes were driven by fraud and flim-flam tactics. Now, how do you get all that into your nut graph of a story? That's something that has confounded us.
Given too much ink?
He's up by 40 points in the primary. I don't know how to define too much ink.
There's an interest, right? If there were no interest, we wouldn't do it.
That's correct. We're responding to market forces, and that's clicks and page views and ratings and open rates on newsletters and ad buys and all that. And we're, you know, we are a business now. We're not just for the public good. So that all that factors in. But, you know, if you're trying to break through to another segment of the voters, and you mentioned all of that, everything that you laid out succinctly, then you're just part of the liberal deep state media who's hell-bent on taking down Trump.
Michael,
when you're just reporting facts. So it's very difficult for us, and it's only going to get more difficult.
Yeah, Michael.
Well, we sure give a lot of attention to Trump. I have to say, as we speak, as you two know, in the ICU unit with my cancer-stricken mom, and I've been pretty much off the grid these past 2 weeks since we've got the diagnosis, and I haven't been paying close attention to a lot of things, and I keep turning down requests to be on TV to talk about legal issues. And it's so refreshing. I mean, not that my mom is dying of cancer, but that I am not having to listen to the daily grind of Trump. And it seems to me there's a lesson there, which is that in some sense, we are all living in a PTSD sort of place because of this outlandish behavior and covering of the Trump machinations. And maybe we would do ourselves as a country a lot of good if there was a little less of it and a little bit more of a return to talking about the things that matter in people's, that should matter in people's lives. So yeah, I think that we hurt ourselves as a country, and we hurt ourselves sort of as individuals, psychologically as individuals, to have this constant, traumatic discussion about Donald Trump.
That's first of all, and now you've not shaming me, but God bless you for doing what you're doing with your mom, because I've gone through it with my pop, and it's not easy. And so, just me to you, love you, and if there's anything I can do, I'd do it. And I think, John, if there's wet work to be done, you just call us. We're in. So let's. But that aside, look, what you say about that is so true on so many levels. I mean, but John, you said it, we make decisions in our business every day based on money, audience share. It's not journalism. And the big problem that we have, I think, in our business is that, Trump went on Meet the Press because he's good for ratings. We do respond to the market. And unfortunately, as long as we are responding to the market, not to, Ben Vagdikian said, ultimately you're responsible not to the owners, not to me, not to yourself. You're responsible to the audience. But we don't take that very seriously because you can't count that. To us, it's not the coin of the realm. But I say that really we should, I think there are millions of people that would tune into the facts if we consistently delivered them. And it's not always about Trump, and it's making better decisions about what it is to be covered from an editorial stance and not from a monetary stance, that I think, honestly, would enhance the bottom line, because facts are the true coin of our realm. Ratings, I think, can be had, and readership can be had if we do it the way we're supposed to. There's my preach. I'm just preaching for a market of solid reporting, because I believe that the marketing people could actually sell that, but that's just me. John?
Yeah, the business has changed. You've been doing this longer than me, but I've watched it change. I've felt it change. I've lived it change.
Too, yeah.
And you're absolutely right that those things now, drive the train in large part. There's still a lot of good traditional work, journalism work going on. But that good, solid work in the business models that a lot of outlets are working under, that doesn't pay the bills. You got to do other things. And that leaves us open to a lot of criticism. I will say, to Michael's point about coverage of Trump, and maybe it's too much and it's too constant. We talked here about the constant part of it is by design. That's Trump still driving narratives and news cycles. But this week, we saw it again, the traumatic part. And I'm glad that Michael used that word. Twice this week, Trump referred to death and senior officials. One was now former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mark Milley, who retired yesterday, and an always cool ceremony here in the Washington area. But Trump's, Trump criticizing Milley for reportedly, back when Trump was still president, Milley talking to his Chinese counterpart, which is a very good thing, by the way, that back channel exists. Not even a back channel, it's a hotline. And it's good that it exists. Those two militaries need to be talking to each other. And, they interpreted the Chinese government interpreted something that Trump said back then very literally. Milley had a regular scheduled call with his Chinese counterpart. What Trump had said came up, and Milley just tried to pour some cold water on it and said, no, he deals in hyperbole. He's not doing that. We're not planning for that. That's not going to happen.
All right. Hold on. I'm sorry. I don't mean but to be specific, and I'll let you go on. Milley did, by talking to the counterpart in China, merely reiterated American policy,
correct,
as it has been since the end of World War II, saying specifically, we will not attack you first. We're not planning to invade you. And that's what got Trump Matt, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I had forgotten the details on that. Yeah. So thank you for adding that.
Yeah.
And Trump this week wrote on his social media platform, which I will not name, that back in the olden times when Americans were tough and didn't take no shit, that would have been considered treason because he was somehow speaking against the president, and Milley would have been executed for that treason. Milley admitted in a television interview, a kind of a farewell interview, that he has and will be taking with him as he transitions into civilian life, security, added security. This is a big, tough guy, career army, you know, he's a ground pounder. Like those guys, you know, and so now Milley, to protect himself and his family, will be, I don't know, maybe perhaps even paying out of pocket for this security detail as he becomes a civilian. And secondly, Trump was ranting and raving about government spending and all sorts of stuff in some social media posts, and went back to Mitch McConnell about the looming shutdown and, you know, the fact that McConnell wants to cut a deal, a bipartisan deal, to avoid a shutdown, said that McConnell has a death wish. And, you know, these implications, he doesn't come out and say it, but all it takes is one or two people to take that very seriously and get lucky and try to do harm to someone that Trump writes about on his social media platform. And after January 6th and other things that have been thwarted by law enforcement, you have to take this very seriously. And clearly Milley does. And I've seen McConnell at the Capitol.
He has security.
That's not a small security detail either. Okay. So, you know, the fact that Mark Milley is taking this so seriously, that tells you what they're seeing with the threat intelligence.
Yeah.
And we don't see that. You know, we don't see that until, well, we might see it if somebody finds it in the bathroom at Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah. Michael?
I think this bird is cooked. We've been through all of what there is to say about it. And, you know, the irony is here we are, you know, an hour into this podcast, and so much of it has been about Donald Trump, and therefore we sort of fall into the same trap, though our motives are different. And I'm not criticizing us. God knows I don't do self-analysis, but I think that
we are above any and all skepticism. Okay.
And criticism. Jeez.
Right. Right.
But, you know, to my point about, you know, sort of the perspective you gain in an ICU unit, there really has to be a turning of the page for us to get back to, you know, sort of a post-PTSD state of mind, collective state of mind nationally. Because I think that people, I personally think, as I, you know, sort of wander the halls of the hospital and stuff, think that people just have their lives that they want to live free of, you know, sort of this discord that we've spent this hour talking about and this country has been dealing with for 7 years. I think people are tired of it. That doesn't answer the question, well, how come he's up 40 points in the polls and the Republican party believes
he can threaten to kill people if he wants.
But I do think we need to move past it. For, you know, for Brian is going to ask me in a minute, where can people find us after this? And as I'll say then, I have this podcast called That Said with Michael Zeldin. But why I say it right this moment, besides, you know, sort of just self-promotion, is I did an interview with Heather Cox Richardson, which I just posted, about the state of our democracy and what we can do to change it. And her point is that democracy is protected best when individuals say, you know, sort of sick and tired, I've had enough, you know, sort of the movie line, and begin to walk in a different direction. I think we really need to think about walking in a different direction in order to put this,
are you talking about
I think is a nightmare behind us.
Are you talking about the line from Network? I'm mad as hell and I don't want to take this anymore.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's right.
I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Yeah. Anyway, so I think Heather Cox Richardson is a jewel, and the conversation I had with her was interesting. But more importantly, I think the point is made that if we really want to take back our democracy, it's time to, you know, put one foot in front of the next and do something rather than, you know, sit back and just moan.
I rarely like moaning except under certain circumstances, but nonetheless, hey now, I know John's shaking his head at me.
Bringing this down to the most base level, time in and time out.
So before we get down there, I would like to say the last thing we wanted to talk about before we leave was the passing of Dianne Feinstein. Any thoughts, guys, before we head off in the past? I look back on her career, and I thought of her as a trailblazer in many ways, but also one of the, back in the day when I first started out, she was pretty easy to approach and get comments from back in the day. And it was always a pleasure as a reporter interacting with her. John?
Yeah, I covered defense and national security for years. And of course, she was a chairman of the Intelligence Committee and I believe ranking member for a while, too. Mm-hmm. And so I had occasion to talk to her about Syria or Iraq or what have you, the conflict of the day or the threat of the day. And, you know, she was, like you said, always approachable, you know, almost always willing to stop and answer your questions. She would sometimes question you back, which I always enjoyed. She liked the banter. She liked the back and forth. For me, you know, it's not any one, you know, women's rights and a lot of civil rights work that she did and championed in the Senate over the years. And even before that, you know, that comes to mind and should be, you know, at the top of her obituary and was in the ones that have been published. But one thing stuck out to me, and we talked about this recently, you know, with Mitt Romney retiring. You know, Feinstein was in the Senate a lot longer than Mitt Romney, but he was a governor, and you know, Bob Corker, Jeff Flake, Dianne Feinstein, Mitt Romney, these are folks who have their beliefs, conservative, progressive, centrist at times, but willing to say, okay, I believe over here, I believe all this much, but to get a deal, I'm going to get this much and you're going to get about the same of what you want. And let's get this thing done. Right. And then let's go vote on it because everybody gets what a little bit of what they want. And then we'll try again with the next piece at some point down the road. Knows how to do that. Understands that, okay, I don't like this CR thing, but in 2 months, you know, I'll get a spending bill, a bigger spending bill, and I'll like a lot of what's in there. So I'll vote for the CR because federal workers deserve to get paid. Military folks deserve to get paid. Federal law enforcement deserves to not get furloughed, right? And maybe have to work while they're getting furloughed. So it's just another person of the age that's fading. And I don't know who the California governor, Gavin Newsom, is going to appoint. And then I don't know who's going to win the election next year to fill the seat for the next 6 years beyond that. But I'm not sure that the folks who are running, the folks who are reported on Newsom's shortlist, you know, I'm not sure they're compromisers. I'm not sure they're deal makers. And she certainly showed that she did have that muscle, and it's just atrophying. And we're going to see it with his government shutdown.
Michael.
Well, so Dianne Feinstein really has to be viewed as one of the great trailblazers for women. She, begins her political career in 1970 on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, and after Mayor Moscone is killed, she becomes the mayor of San Francisco, where she served for a decade before joining the Senate in 1992. So she's 30 years in the Senate, a decade as mayor on the Board of Supervisors from 70 to 78. So since 1970. This Dianne Feinstein has been a leading progressive voice in politics. And I think she should be remembered for all of the wonderful things she's done in her life, especially in respect of the proof that women can do everything at least as well as men. And I think that we should be grateful to her for her national service.
And with that said, we bring another addition to close, and I didn't have to debase myself to do it. So well, thank you guys for joining us. John, where can we catch you?
Oh boy, it's gonna be a hell of a week. CQ afternoon briefing, CQ.com. Subscribe today, and maybe I'll make it till Friday and file a column for rollcall.com.
There you go. And Michael.
As I said, the podcast is called That Said with Michael Zeldin on all major podcast apps. I talked a moment ago about the serious conversation I had with Heather Cox Richardson. I have other serious ones upcoming too. But for those of you, to my point, that want to return to normalcy from this PTSD world, the week after, my interview is going to be with David Zucker, Jerry Zucker, Jim Abraham. Who wrote and directed Airplane. And we're going to talk about the making of Airplane, which I'm in the middle of rewatching as I prepare myself for that interview. And all these many years later, there are some things in there that just stand as, you know, testament to the comedic genius of these guys. Surely you must be serious. I am serious. Don't call me Shirley. And my favorite is,
surely you jest.
No, my favorite is the protagonist Stryker, the guy with PTSD from his war years, is on an airplane. He hasn't been on an airplane since his plane crashed in the war, and he's very nervous. And the woman sitting next to him says, "Are you nervous?" He says, "Very." She says, "First time?" He says, "No, I've been
there lots of times."
I think personally is the funniest line in the entire movie.
Oh, there's a lot in that movie, man. We could do a whole podcast on that. Just the idea of when the woman starts screaming and there's a whole line to walk up and beat her into submission. We got to get these people to the hospital. What is it? He goes, it's the building where all the sick people go, but that's not important now.
The physical gags are a little bit, age a little bit less well than the
slapstick.
Than the dialogue. The dialogue.
The dialogue is sharp, but the slapstick just takes you back to, Three Stooges and all the other stuff. So that I loving that, all of that stays with me. But
right. In prepping for the interview, I was listening to them talk in other interviews, and one person said, could you make this movie today? He said, oh, sure, but without the comedy.
Yes. Oh yeah, I had the fish. And anyway, we could go on. So John, thanks, and Michael, thanks. So this is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. The name of the book is called Free the Press, now in its third printing, wherever fine books are sold, where we often talk about in that book all the problems with today's press and how to cure all the ills. It's a panacea, a cornucopia. And then the column is onsalon.com every Thursday. And wherever other columns are seen or heard on, might be there too, as well as on TV. So all that fun stuff aside, thanks for joining us. This is Just Ask the Press on Just Ask the Question, and we will catch you again next week. Thanks.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.